worldwide news update. The U.S. Justice Department is asking federal judges to dismiss two cases against President-elect Donald Trump. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The department is abandoning both its election interference and classified documents cases against Trump. Department prosecutors are citing long-standing guidance that a sitting president cannot be prosecuted. And right, the Constitution requires the cases be dismissed before Trump is inaugurated. Both moves were expected after Trump's election win, and his spokesman calls them a major victory for the rule of law. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Israeli airstrikes are hitting Lebanon as negotiations progress toward a ceasefire between the country and Lebanon-based Hezbollah militants. Lebanon reported that at least 31 people were killed Monday as explosions lit up the sky and airstrikes hit targets in Beirut and in Tyre, a southern port city. Israeli troops launched a ground invasion of Lebanon in October after about a year of exchanging low-level attacks across the Israel-Lebanon border with Iran-backed Hezbollah militants. More than 3,700 people have since been killed and 1.2 million displaced. The fighting has amplified worries about direct conflict between Israel and Iran. International mediators are seeking to broker a ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah to end the fighting. The proposal under discussion to end the fighting calls for an initial two-month ceasefire. A top Hamas official in Lebanon said the Palestinian militant group would support a ceasefire between its ally Hezbollah and Israel. This is VOA News. New research finds the number of people killed in Sudan's civil war is far higher than previously thought. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Sudan's civil war erupted in April 2023, a brutal power struggle between the army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. An estimate widely used by international aid agencies said just over 20,000 civilians had died from the violence in the first 14 months of the war. But a new study from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine looked at multiple sources and suggests the death rate is much higher. Maysoon Dahab is lead author of the report.
In the first 14 months of the war, there has been a 50% increase in the death rate in Khartoum State alone. That amounts to about 61,000 deaths due to disease, starvation, and directly from the violence itself. Amongst that 61,000, we have about 26,000 who have been killed directly by violence.
The United Nations says the conflict has forced 11 million people to flee their homes, with some 25 million people, half of Sudan's population, needing food aid, making it the world's biggest hunger crisis. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
Scuffles and fistfights broke out between ruling party and opposition lawmakers in Serbia's parliament on Monday over a deadly rail station roof collapse that has ignited tensions in the Balkan state. The opposition wanted to discuss who was responsible for the crash that killed 15 people in the northern city of Novi Sad on November 1st. The collapse has fueled widespread anger toward the government and protests, becoming a flashpoint for broader dissatisfaction with Serbia's authoritarian rule. The fifth and final round of negotiations for a global plastics treaty began on Monday. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Negotiators are gathering in Busan, South Korea, in what's billed as a final push to address the global crisis of plastic pollution. Opening the talks, Inge Andersen, who leads the UN Environment Programme, says the world needs an end to plastic production.
Not a single person on this planet wants to witness plastic litter in green spaces, on their streets, are washing up on their shores.
The planet is choking on plastic, according to the UN, polluting lakes, rivers, oceans, and people's bodies. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
criminal cases against President-elect Trump have been dropped.
Prosecutors said a long-standing DOJ policy, which maintains that sitting presidents should not face criminal prosecution, requires the case to be dismissed before Trump takes office in January.
Are we close to a deal between Israel and Hezbollah?
Nothing is final until everything is final. We continue to work to try and get an agreement over the line, and we're hopeful we can get one.
And a look at the staggering death toll in Sudan.
In the first 14 months of the war, there has been a 50% increase in the death rate in Khartoum State alone. That amounts to about 61,000 deaths.
Today is Tuesday, November 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Monday evening in Washington, President-elect Donald Trump took to social media and pledged a 25% tariff on all products from Mexico and Canada on his first day in office, and an additional 10% tariff on goods from China. The AP's Norman Hall has the details.
As part of his efforts to crack down on illegal immigration and drugs, President-elect Donald Trump is threatening to impose sweeping new tariffs on Mexico, Canada, and China as soon as he takes office. In a pair of posts on his Truth Social site Monday evening, Trump wrote that on January 20th, he will sign executive orders to charge Mexico and Canada a 25% tariff on all products coming into the U.S. Trump also threatened to charge China an additional 10% tariff. It's unclear whether Trump will actually go through with the tariffs or if he's using them as a negotiating tactic before he takes office in the new year. Norman Hall, Washington.
Trump said the tariffs would remain in place until the countries can clamp down on illegal drugs, particularly fentanyl, and migrants crossing the border illegally. Trump's threatened new tariff would appear to violate the terms of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement on Trade, which Trump signed into law and took effect in 2020. Economists say that Trump's overall tariff plans, likely his most consequential economic policy, would push the U.S. import duty rates back up to 1930s-era levels, stoke inflation, collapse U.S.-China trade, draw retaliation, and drastically reorder supply chains. Mark Hamrick is Washington Bureau Chief and Senior Economic Analyst for Bankrate.com.
First of all, tariffs are effectively a tax that have to be paid by some combination of companies and consumers. And so if you're applying, let's say, a 20% across the board tariff on imported goods, that has to be passed along.
Despite this, Trump frequently refers to countries as paying a consequence. On Monday, Trump said that Mexico and Canada will pay a very big price.
And so let's make this clear. This is not something that China pays out of pocket. There's no mechanism for that. That's not how it works. It is either paid by companies or it is paid by consumers or some combination thereof. And so that is why, in totality, many of the proposals that President Trump has talked about are seen as potentially harmful for inflation.
The tariffs, if implemented, would dramatically raise prices on everything in the U.S., from gas to automobiles. The U.S. is the largest importer of goods in the world, with Mexico, China, and Canada as its top three suppliers, according to the most recent census data. And in other Donald Trump news, two criminal cases against former and future President Donald Trump have been dropped. And while the move has been expected since his re-election, it's still a major victory for Trump. You might remember that Trump was indicted on multiple counts for his alleged role in the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, for trying to stop the certification of Joe Biden's election victory, and for having classified documents with him at his personal home after he left office. It's not clear, however, if he can be recharged when he leaves office. Alan Morrison, the dean of the George Washington University Law School, tells me that he could be charged again, but he might have a statute of limitations defense, which would not be able to be decided unless the DOJ refiles. Jillian Kitchener has more.
A U.S. judge on Monday dismissed the federal criminal case accusing Donald Trump of attempting to overturn his 2020 election defeat. That came after special counsel Jack Smith, the lead prosecutor overseeing the case, moved to dismiss it and also end his attempt to revive a separate case accusing Trump of illegally retaining classified documents after leaving office in 2021. The moves represent a huge legal victory for Trump. Prosecutors said a long-standing DOJ policy, which maintains that sitting presidents should not face criminal prosecution, requires the case to be dismissed before Trump takes office in January. It's also a major pivot by Smith, who obtained indictments against Trump in the two cases, accusing him of crimes that threatened U.S. election integrity and national security. The 2020 election subversion case came after a probe into Trump's attempts to hold on to power following his loss to Joe Biden and following the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. In August of last year, Trump had pleaded not guilty to four federal charges accusing him of conspiring to obstruct the collection and certification of votes following his 2020 loss. Upon taking office, Trump had been expected to order an end to both the 2020 election case and to Smith's appeal in the documents case.
That's Jillian Kitchener of Reuters reporting for us. Turning now to the Middle East, the United States is pushing as hard as it can to get a truce in Lebanon, but cautioned that an agreement has not yet been achieved.
What I'd say is we have made significant progress with getting towards a resolution. That includes progress from where we were when I spoke to this last week, but we're not done yet. Nothing is final until everything is final. We continue to work to try and get an agreement over the line, and we're hopeful we can get one, but we need both of the parties to get to yes.
That's U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller. Meanwhile, four senior Lebanese sources say that U.S. President Joe Biden and French President Emmanuel Macron were expected to announce a ceasefire in Lebanon between the armed group Hezbollah and Israel within 36 hours. For his part, Miller says the State Department doesn't believe they have an agreement yet.
Look, we don't believe we have an agreement yet. We believe we're close to an agreement. We believe that we have narrowed the gap significantly, but there are still steps that we need to see taken, but we hope that we can get there.
The U.S. has pushed for a ceasefire deal between Hezbollah, which is backed by Iran, and Israel to end the fighting that erupted in October of 2023 in parallel with Israel's war against Iran-backed Palestinian militant group Hamas in Gaza. The conflict in Lebanon, however, has drastically escalated over the past 2 months. In a related story, Qatar says that Hamas political leaders have left its territory and that several of them have gone to Turkey, prompting protests last week from Washington, which warned the Turkish government not to give them sanctuary. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is a supporter of Hamas and insists channels of dialogue need to remain open. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Qatar suspended mediation efforts between Hamas and Israel earlier this month and announced the militant group's negotiators had left the Gulf state. Washington has since warned Turkey not to host the Hamas leaders. As U.S. State Department spokesman Matthew Miller underlined last week to reporters.
We don't believe the leaders of a vicious terrorist organization should be living comfortably anywhere.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is a staunch backer of Hamas and describes the group as a liberation movement, even declaring a national day of mourning for assassinated Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh. Analysts say Hamas leaders have been regular visitors to Turkey. Soli Özel teaches international relations at the Institute for Human Sciences in Vienna.
They have been coming and going to Turkey for years. Haniyeh was assassinated by the Israelis in Tehran, was in Turkey on the 7th of October 2023.
Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan has said there are no plans for Hamas to open a political bureau in Turkey. But Ankara insists it will continue its policy of engagement and hosting Hamas members. Mesut Cashin, a Turkish presidential advisor, is a professor of international relations at Istanbul's Yeditepe University.
Ankara will continue his position, number one. Number two, they will continue dialogue with the Hamas in order to establish peace. The urgently we need to peace and stability. And if we cut they triumph the Hamas. You will talk together whom?
Israel is targeting Hamas leadership for assassination, but so far there have been no attacks reported in Turkey. Israel says Hamas, a U.S.-designated terror group, should not consider Turkey a safe haven. Gali Lindenstrauss is a foreign policy specialist at the Institute for National Security Studies in Tel Aviv.
According to Israeli leaders, no. They will find these Hamas leaders and target them wherever they find them. But I have to say that Turkey has threatened Israel not to, to operate on its soil. So again, this creates unnecessary tensions in a region that already suffers from so much tensions.
Hamas is still holding more than 100 Israelis hostage. And analysts say that despite Israel's condemnation of Turkey over its links to Hamas, Ankara's connections remain useful for Israel. This was apparent this month when reports said that the head of Israel's Shin Bet intelligence agency met in Turkey with his Turkish counterpart. Again, international relations analyst Soli Ozel.
Turkey and Israel have one way of dealing with one another in public and another way of dealing with one another diplomatically and in security cooperation. That's always been the case.
Israelis have praised U.S. President-elect Donald Trump's record as a staunch supporter of Israel, prompting some here to warn that links to Hamas threaten to be a big liability for Turkey and a significant point of tension with the new U.S. administration. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
And here are some more stories we're following from around the world. Israel's cabinet unanimously voted Sunday to boycott the country's oldest newspaper, Haaretz, citing its critical coverage of the Israel-Hamas conflict and comments by the publisher calling for sanctions on top government officials. The proposal will end government advertising in the left-leaning newspaper and cancel all subscriptions for state employees and employees of state-owned companies. Russia's military captured a British national fighting with the Ukrainian troops who occupied part of Russia's Kursk region. This, according to news reports on Monday, the man was identified by state news agency TASS and other media as James Scott Reese Anderson. TASS quoted him as saying that he had served as a signalman in the British Army for 4 years and then joined the International Legion of Ukraine. Scuffles and fistfights broke out between ruling party and opposition lawmakers in Serbia's parliament on Monday over a deadly rail station roof collapse that ignited tensions in the country. The opposition wanted to discuss who was responsible for the incident that had killed 15 people. The collapse has fueled widespread anger towards the authoritarian government. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karen. Turning now to American politics and the transition of presidents. Former lawmaker Lee Zeldin has been nominated by President-elect Donald Trump to head the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency in Trump's new administration. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias takes a look at Zeldin's credentials and how the agency's priorities are expected to change, particularly when it comes to climate change regulations.
Lee Zeldin is a former four-term Republican congressman from New York State and a longtime supporter of President-elect Donald Trump. Zeldin is poised to become the next administrator of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. The 44-year-old holds a law degree from Albany Law School and served 4 years on active duty in the U.S. Army. He's married and has twin daughters. In a statement released on November 11th, Trump announced Zeldin's nomination, saying the former congressman will, quote, unleash the power of American businesses while at the same time maintaining the highest environmental standards. Zeldin told Fox News he's excited to implement Trump's economic agenda.
There are regulations that the left wing of this country have been advocating through regulatory power that ends up causing businesses to go in the wrong direction.
Under Democratic President Joe Biden's administration, the EPA has prioritized the production of clean and renewable power and put restrictions on oil and gas production in a bid to curb toxic emissions and fight climate change. President-elect Trump envisions a different formula.
We will blast through every bureaucratic hurdle to issue rapid approvals for new drilling,
new pipelines, new refineries, new power plants, new electric plants, and reactors of all types.
Zeldin voiced similar positions when he unsuccessfully ran for governor of New York in 2022.
We should reverse the state's ban on the safe extraction of natural gas and approve new pipeline applications.
Zeldin's nomination comes as the United Nations renewed its call on countries to move away from fossil fuels to combat global warming. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
The sound you hear is the ticking clock. We are in the final countdown to limit global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius. And time is not on our side.
Even as climate change regulations are expected to be scaled back at the federal level under Zeldin's leadership, analysts note that currently states can choose to enact their own regulations and consumers can individually opt for green solutions. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News.
On Monday, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky called Britain's new sanctions on Russia an important step and called the European Union to follow suit.
Ми відповімо Росії обов'язково на все, що вона робить, і важливо, щоб такі удари кожен з них не залишив.
Britain is imposing the biggest sanctions package against Russia's shadow fleet targeting 30 vessels. Foreign Minister David Lammy said on Monday, urging allies to stand with and equip Ukraine for as long as it needs. Lammy told reporters that Britain's latest round of measures against Moscow represented the biggest package of sanctions against the Russian shadow fleet, which are ships that Britain says try to avoid Western restrictions on Russian oil. Publishing details of the sanctions, Britain said the ships being targeted had transported billions of dollars worth of oil and oil products in the last year, and the new measure would bring the number of oil tankers under UK sanctions to 73. Britain also said two Russian insurance companies are facing sanctions. Turning now to Africa, the wife of Ugandan opposition politician Zigi Besigye has said she does not expect him to get a fair trial, this after he was detained in neighboring Kenya, returned home and accused of possessing weapons and other offenses in a military court. Rachel Graham of Reuters has that story.
In the military court, we do not expect to get justice.
Winnie Bianima is the wife of Ugandan opposition politician Kizza Besigye. The longtime rival of Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni disappeared from Kenya's capital earlier in November. He reappeared at a military court in Uganda alongside co-accused Haji Obed Lutale, charged with several offenses, including illegal possession of firearms. Both Amnesty International and a senior official at Kenya's foreign ministry have described the incident as an abduction.
He wasn't tortured, but he was sat on all the way. They packed them in a little car. They sat on them, on him and on Obed. And by the time he arrived in Kampala, he said he could hardly walk.
Bianima, who is also the executive director of UN agency UNAIDS, says the charges are politically motivated.
This is not just about Kizza Besigye. This is about how the opposition can have its space, healthy space, to play its role in a constitutional democracy.
A Ugandan military spokesman dismissed Bianima's statement, saying the court would follow the law. Bianima also believes the people who caught Besigye were Ugandan operatives.
They were first of all trying to pretend to be Kenyans and were speaking Swahili, but even before they got to the border, they forgot. And one of them then went on his phone rang and he picked it up and forgot and he spoke Rinyankwe. which Kenyan speaks Rinyankwe? You see, so he knows who brought him. He doesn't know them personally, but they were Ugandan.
Uganda's government did not comment on the specific case, but said arrests abroad were done in collaboration with host countries. Ugandan opposition and rights activists have long accused Museveni's government of using the military court to punish political opponents, a charge the government denies.
That's Reuters' Rachel Graham reporting. And finally today, roughly 2,300 kilometers north of Kampala, we go to Khartoum. The number of people killed in Sudan's civil war, tragically, is higher than previously thought. This according to new research. The conflict has forced 11 million people to flee their homes and has created the world's worst hunger crisis. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Khartoum's residential streets are lined with hundreds of graves. Cemeteries have run out of space. Abdin Kadir is an undertaker in Omdurman, a western district of Khartoum.
The numbers of dead became really big. We bury at least 50 people per day. These are all fresh bodies.
Sudan's civil war erupted in April 2023, a brutal power struggle between the army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. An estimate widely used by international aid agencies said just over 20,000 civilians had died from the violence in the first 14 months of the war. But a new study from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine looked at multiple sources and suggests the death rate is much higher. Maysoon Dahab is lead author of the report.
In the first 14 months of the war, there has been a 50% increase in the death rate in Khartoum State alone. That amounts to about 61,000 deaths due to disease, starvation, and directly from the violence itself. Amongst that 61,000, we have about 26,000 who have been killed directly by violence.
Separately, the aid group Doctors Without Borders says that since January this year, one in six of its patients at a Khartoum hospital were children under 15. Many sustained severe injuries from gunshots, blasts, and shrapnel. There's also been a rise in cases of severe malnutrition among children. The United Nations says the conflict has forced 11 million people to flee their homes, with some 25 million people, half of Sudan's population, needing food aid, making it the world's biggest hunger crisis. It's vital that more is done to end the suffering, says Dahab.
So in the case of the international community, ensuring the understanding that aid efforts need to be increased, scaled, and put out to inaccessible populations. In terms of actors who are shaping the war, what we hope to put out in terms of the research is the true price of this war, so that they are able to make their decision based on those facts.
The United States Special Envoy for Sudan, Thomas Perriello, traveled to Khartoum last week for talks with Sudan's army chief.
We also share the aspiration for this war to end as soon as possible, to see an end to the horrific atrocities.
There are few signs that either the Sudanese army or the Rapid Support Forces are ready to agree a truce. Meanwhile, Russia last week vetoed a UN Security Council resolution calling for a ceasefire, saying the process excluded Sudan itself. Britain, which sponsored the resolution alongside Sierra Leone, labeled Moscow's veto a disgrace. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
And that'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.